argument is 19-1884, Kitkinsa versus United States.
May it please the court, Gary Hoskin for the United States. We have present two issues here today for the court's consideration. The first one is defining the term position of the United States in the attorney's fees provision of 28 U.S. Code 1498A. And secondly, regardless of the outcome of that first issue, we would also ask the court to find as error the lower court's decision not to scale damages in this case in accordance with the Supreme Court's decisions in Henley and Farrar. The question presented by the United States is limited specifically to the definition of position of the United States in that provision, which is a little bit broader, and the full statement is position of the United States as was substantially justified. The substantially justified portion has been previously...
Let me just move forward here. Let's assume, for sake of argument, that we agree with you on the statutory interpretation. We agree with the district court that the Court of Federal Claims erred. Is there not enough in the opinion in terms of his reliance on the litigation conduct? If you parse through what should therefore come out and what should stay in. He didn't make an alternative holding, but he has some strong language, particularly at A19, about arguments directed towards showing of obviousness failed to address an essential element of each of three asserted claims or demonstrate any motion to combine. Those are all good findings, right, under your view of
We dispute some of those, Your Honor, but...
Yeah, you may dispute them, but that's a different issue. But there are a number of findings in his opinion that don't go to the pre-litigation conduct or don't rely on that. So my question to you is, can you tell me why on this record, based on these findings, even if we agree with you on the statutory construction, there is not enough basis to affirm?
Your Honor, I think given the standard of review on the second part of that, which is abuse of discretion, I think that the court certainly could find that. I don't think they should find it. I think it should be remanded for a new decision. But if the court wanted to do so, I think it could find that based on the findings of the court set under the correct standard, that there is sufficient evidence there.
I appreciate that.
And once again, I would reiterate that I don't think that the court should go that way, but it can. The court's basic error here as to the first question was that it's a reliance on the Supreme Court case of Commissioner versus Jean, which was a post-EJA amendment case that applied a specific amendment that defined position of the United States for the EJA statute. That statute does not apply to 1498. 1498 was amended subsequent to the EJA statute.
Your basic argument is that we have to understand the history of what happened here.
Correct.
Because you have a whole body of law before EJA gets amended in 1986.
Correct.
And that whole body of law teaches us something about pre-litigation conduct, whether it's in or out, right?
Correct. And specifically this court's...
And then we have an amendment by Congress of the EJIA to say, oh, wait a second, pre-litigation conduct counts when you're measuring the position of the United States. They give a subsection of the statute expressly directed to that.
Correct.
A few years, not that many years later, the question comes up about whether or not one should have attorney's fees in 1498.
Correct.
And so the decision is made, yes, we should have attorney's fees in 1498. And so the first iteration in the House of Representatives is there'll be, if you have prevailed, there'll be, and the Justice Department comes in and says, wait a second, you should allow us to be saying, you know, that our position was substantially justified, right?
Correct.
And so what happened was the whole question of substantial justification, what goes into it, was up in the air. And Congress chose to use the pre-1986 definition, if you will, is your view, in the statute, rather than simply incorporating all of the amended EJIA into 1498A.
That, in substance, yes, not in procedure. But what they did is they used the same language, but without the specific definition, which they knew about and did not employ.
Well, we assume they knew about it.
Well, it's those, that is that is the rule. Judicial standard. That, but I think there's sufficient evidence in the record in the congressional hearing record that they were looking at just the broader concept of substantial justification.
Well, they said we want to line it up with EJIA.
I don't think they wanted to necessarily line it up with EJIA totally.
Wasn't that when Justice came in to complain? They said, hey, you got to line this up with EJIA. What were the exact words of Justice's letter to into the legislative history that the Senate responded to?
I'm sorry, I do not have it.
I think they were quoted in Judge Letow's opinion, I believe.
I'm not sure I have it here easily, but I would agree with the with you, Judge Clevenger, that the Justice Department came in and asked for it to be aligned because the provision was even broader than EJIA, and Justice asked that
it was broader than EJIA because it didn't take the position of the government into account at all.
Correct.
The original.
It awarded a fees in almost every case.
Right.
And this cut it back.
Isn't the essence of your argument here really that pre-litigation conduct in the context of these kind of cases is sort of like a term of art? It doesn't mean, as your adversary says, everything that's historic.
That's correct.
You're saying it's a term of art. And when it arises in EJIA cases, it's in the context of the behavior of the agency that took the action that's complained of.
That is correct.
So you're asking, was it arbitrary and capricious? Was the action really wrong? And as a result, it meant somebody had to do a whole lot of litigating to get someplace.
That is correct.
You take that background of what pre-litigation conduct is all about, and you swap that into a 1498 cause of action. You say, shoe doesn't fit. Because nobody cares about the motive of the government in infringing.
That is
right.
That is
because it's a free shot. It's a
correct.
Free shot. You get to. So the kinds of considerations you would take into consideration in a standard EJIA, you know, was the Corps of Engineers correct in denying you the permit to build your house?
Yeah, right. That is correct.
I mean, what was sort of the quality of their behavior? I mean, did they force someone into a whole lot of work they didn't have to do? No one cares about that.
Correct.
So you say there's really no room for the concept of pre-litigation conduct to function in an infringement action.
That is true. We go a little bit further than that because in this particular case, the judge actually went to things that wouldn't even be pre-litigation conduct under EJIA, and went to for an example being.
Well, that's actually an example of him having gone too far.
Correct, But I mean, he would have gone too far even under EJIA.
What do you think the specific things are that he took into account that went too far?
Well, the three that we mentioned, I think most particularly, I think there are some other things that we just dispute, but the three in particular that we pointed out were the alleged breach of a non-disclosure agreement at its appendix page 18, taking sole credit for patented inventions at Oak Ridge Laboratory, which was somehow believed to be a factor.
So you think these, is it because these bad acts, arguable bad acts, are not really linked to the position? We're supposed to be focusing on the position the government took. The government took a position of non-infringement. That's what these acts relate
Correct.
To. And so is it because when you say, you know, breach of non-disclosure or, I mean, I personally am having trouble seeing the link between those pieces of evidence and the position you took of non-infringement. Is that the reason?
That is in part the reason.
Suppose this was the case. Suppose right before litigation was filed, you all had a flurry of emails back and forth about how you clearly infringe this and have no good faith non-infringement argument. However, this is a small entity and we can bully them right out of court. Okay, I know this would never happen. I'm not suggesting anything to the contrary. But suppose there's this flurry of emails back and forth and somehow they become of record ultimately. And you do in fact take the very non-infringement position that in those emails you suggested would be, you know, a non-starter. And so then in litigation, you've taken the position of non-infringement of a specific element. Would it really be your view that that flurry of emails that may have occurred right before the litigation was filed would not be allowed to be looked at to assess as evidence? Are they relevant to assess the position the government did ultimately take and whether it was substantially justified?
Well, as I understand your question, this is a flurry of emails between the plaintiff and the government.
I don't even know who they're between. I guess the point I'm trying to
make is, of course, they're relevant, and of course they affected.
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Well, let me just explain why I think they are, and then you can tell me why I'm wrong about that. Because it's hard to get I've had a hard time getting my head around where you draw the line, and it seems to me that of course you can look at pre-litigation facts to determine whether the litigation position is unjustified. You just can't make a determination on the alleged impropriety of the pre-litigation actions themselves. Is that a fair characterization? There's a difference. You can look at pre-litigation facts, right?
You can look at pre-litigation facts that are material to...
Yeah, so if you have pre-litigation, if you have the emails described by Judge Moore, that is relevant to whether or not your current litigating position is justified. No?
Not as I understand Judge
Moore. Well, let me refine it a little bit. What happens if after the patent is issued, the woman that got the patent, and she's still having an ongoing gripe with the government, and she goes and has a meeting, and she sits down with them and says, you know, it really irritates me to beat the band because you're infringing my patent, and you shouldn't do that. And the government guy says, of course we are. Of course we are. Everybody knows we're infringing. We know it. We're doing it. Yes, we are. And that's recorded. That's a historic fact that's recorded. That's the government's pre-litigation conduct saying we infringe. And then the government comes to trial and denies infringement. Should that statement that the woman inventor had her phone, she recorded it, should that be considered as pre-litigation conduct?
I think it
yes or no.
I think that can be considered as pre-litigation conduct. I don't think it can be considered as a position of the United States pre-litigation.
Not the position, but can this kind of evidence that preceded the date of the litigation itself, can that evidence be used to evaluate whether the position actually taken in litigation is substantially justified or not?
That depends very specifically on the evidence.
A
statement, for instance, from an agency person saying we infringe I don't think that does.
Why isn't that the position in the United States? Let's assume it's the highest ranking person in the whole place. It's a real official officer.
If it's a real official officer, it would. If it's just some other person, it may not.
Right.
Doesn't that just go to the weight of the evidence, what I'm suggesting? It's not that it can't be the position of the government that no evidence that existed prior to the day of litigation could ever be used to support an argument that the government's actual litigation position is not substantially justified. I just can't imagine that.
As in my discussions with Judge Clevenger, I have said that that is the case. That we agree that facts, material facts, are relevant.
Right, evidence.
And they certainly can be evidence. Now, one of the problems that I am having here is certainly not every person that makes a statement binds the United States.
No, that's a different issue.
That's kind of underlying where we're going here.
It's not, because binding the United States is an entirely different question from whether the position is substantially justified or not. If 1,000 engineers who don't have authority to bind the United States, but nonetheless circulate an email chain saying we infringe because our battery really is in fact exactly the battery that's claimed. You know, honestly, it's not whether they bind the government or not, but the mere fact that all of these people thought so might be allowed to be weighed into whether the position that's ultimately taken is substantially justified.
It certainly might. Yes, I would agree with you there. It might.
Okay.
It would not necessarily.
Can I turn to you for just a couple minutes on this amount thing? Because I think Hensley is a different kind of a case. I think Farrar is really different. I mean, here, Hensley is about parsing. You win two claims and lose on 48. Mm-hmm. What happens with respect to the attorney's fees? To me, that's not this case, right?
No.
And even Farrar is a little different because it's about compensable injury, and here it was nominal damages. It seems to me those don't really go nearly as far as you would need to establish that here. I mean, it's not even that she sought $200,000 and she spent $5 million in attorney's fees. It's she sought an amount that would have justified all of these attorney's fees. She just won on the merits and lost on the amount. I don't see how this case comes close to being able to dislodge the attorney's fees because of the differential in the amount. So you can tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, I think there's two parts to that. First is that I think that regardless of the context, that both Hensley and Farrar require are indications that the Supreme Court says that scaling is appropriate, that it has to reflect the end result.
Yeah, well, that's a broad statement, but the context in which it's been applied is not close to what happened here.
The second part of my answer is that in this case in particular, everything over $200,000 was pretty much stipulated. Both experts said $200,000. The rest of it, the court found...
Well, $200,000 based on a theory that if this is your theory, that's what you get. She had another theory based on which she would get a larger sum.
Correct.
And so the question was, does that theory applicable?
And the court found that the theory had no basis.
I understand that, but so she lost on that claim. She got all she could possibly get under the law.
Correct.
On the infringement claim.
Right.
And so why don't you say that's a complete victory? Why are you talking about whittling down the amount of attorney's fees?
Well, because it's
you
not
might,
a complete
You might want to try
victory.
To go in and argue, well, the amount of the fees that she used to argue the theory that she lost on, you whittle that out. But that's not your point on the case law.
No, it's the point.
On the case law is simply the size. She asked for $5 million. She only got $200,000. Therefore, you have to whittle down the attorney's fees.
Yes, and I think it goes a step further here because part of that $5 million was that the claim itself had no basis. It was meritless. So if
claim wasn't meritless. Her claim was one of infringement, and that was actually found to be meritorious. You're saying her particular argument for that research grant that she lost out on.
Theory of damages.
Her theory of damages was meritless.
Okay, yeah. We're way beyond
that. I understand you're on.
Say one thing. I mean, I found this to be a fascinating issue, and since all of this in 1498 emanates out of the takings clause, I went back and looked at the last 5 years, 10 years of the government's takings cases, and in which there have been claims for damages much higher than the person actually got. And I never saw this argument being made. I mean, you have a situation where, you know, there's erosion, and the question is how long has it been going on, and the plaintiffs, the takings plaintiff wants the moon and they get half the moon. But I never said none of that case law discusses whittling down the size of attorney's fee awards.
Well, I think that's, if I may, Your Honor, I think there's a very specific reason for that. In EJIA itself, for takings claims, there is a different standard. And the standard is who gets the fees, who gets their fees is based on whether you're closer to the amount claimed or the government's amount. And it's pretty much a by, you know.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Your Honors, this case presents the exact circumstances that 1498 was amended to address. They inserted the fee-shifting provision in 1996 to protect small companies like Ms. Walker and her companies who were forced to pursue a claim against the government and combat the resources of the federal government. This is exactly why Ms. Walker was able to pursue her claim in this case, is as a result of the amendment to the statute.
If the government had made its fee reduction argument not on the theory of 200 versus 500, therefore she should get 1/20th of the attorney's fees, but rather had said she should only get the attorney's fees that were devoted to the issues upon which she prevailed, what would you say in response to that argument?
Judge Leto specifically addressed that in his opinion, Your Honor, at Appendix 25, and he says the status of the research funding represented a subset of the damages aspect of the infringement claim. In the next sentence, he said, arguments focused on the status of research funding did not present a distinct claim, nor was the issue sufficiently significant to warrant identifying and eliminating costs associated subset.
That's not what I asked you. Okay. I wasn't asking you about the facts of this case. I have no qualms with Judge Leto's extremely well-written and thoroughly articulated opinion.
I misunderstood your question. I apologize.
What I was trying to ask you is, would you agree under the law that if you were able to parse out, like suppose your attorney billable records said, you know, here's the time I spent on infringement for claim one, here's the time I spent on infringement for claim two, and you only prevailed on claim one and didn't prevail on claim two, would it have been fair of the government to ask for a proportional award of fees based on the issues upon which you prevailed?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question before. In direct respect, in this particular case, no, Your Honor, and here's why. Because the cases that support...
But I understand you say in this case, no, you acknowledge and accept then that the statute doesn't require all or nothing.
No, what I'm suggesting is you have to look at, in this particular case, there was a single claim, and that was a claim for infringement. We prevailed on that claim.
Okay, I'm going to try for a third time.
I guess then I'm not understanding.
Give up. Isn't it possible if there were more than one claim?
It's a hypothetical.
And you didn't win on all of them.
Yes,
that the government would be entitled to dispute your entire fee award and say you should only get the proportion that was directed to the actual claim that you prevailed on and not the portions of your fees spent on the claims you didn't prevail on.
That has never been addressed in 1498.
That's
but applying the others, I agree. I agree that is a possibility if the facts were presented.
That's what Hensley was, the Supreme Court case, where they say if you've got multiple claims and you only prevail on some of them, quote,
agreed,
where they fail to prevail on a claim that is distinct in all respects from his successful claims, the hours spent on the unsuccessful claim should be excluded from the attorney's fees award.
I
think that's your hypothetical.
I know, I was just trying to get him to
know.
Then I misunderstood and I apologize.
You tried and unsuccessfully, so.
I want to talk about briefly about the government's raising about the position of the United States being substantially justified. In this particular case, we've not disputed nor ever disputed that the position of the United States that is to be evaluated is the positions that were taken in the litigation. In this particular case, in non-infringement and invalidity. And that's what Judge Leto examined to determine whether or not those positions were substantially justified. And in doing that, he went back and he looked at the underlying facts. And he applied the standard that's also not in dispute. Namely, whether or not the government's positions, non-infringement and invalidity, had a reasonable basis in fact and law. And he went back and he looked at the underlying facts that gave rise to the infringement. And specifically what he looked at is he looked at when Ms. Walker went. And she went to Oak Ridge to solicit their help. She had this idea and she needed some help to try to prove that it worked so she could commercialize it. She went there and she disclosed it to them. She was concerned about the secrecy, ironically, because she wanted to make sure that they wouldn't take it. But they changed the focus, Dr. Ludka in particular, changed the focus of his invention from that time, a single energy, to after receiving her invention, changed the focus to two energies, magnet and thermal, with the thermal introducing an oscillatory energy that made the magic happen. And that's what Judge Leto was referring to in terms of they took that, took credit for it, went and secured and applied for industry awards about the two energies and the oscillatory, went and published articles. And then they come to, this isn't a case where they came to trial and they said, you're right, we took it. Let's talk about how much this is worth. It's akin to like an eminent domain case, I would think, where the government comes and tears the person's house down, and instead of talking about what they owe him for the destruction, they say, well, you need to prove that we did it. So they spend many years trying to prove that what everybody knows, that the government tore down the house. And that's the same here. Judge Leto had a front row seat to watching the government make us prove what everybody knew and what all the undisputed facts and evidence showed, that Oak Ridge was using an oscillatory energy source, which was their principal non-infringement argument at trial. And also, as Your Honors noted earlier, the arguments that they were presented at trial were in direct contradiction and relied on a rejected claim construction that Judge Leto had interpreted 3 years previously. So they spent the next 3 years, including at trial, not only presenting arguments that had no basis, but they were expressly premised on claim construction arguments that Judge Leto had considered and rejected 3 years previously. The government standards where they say, we don't want you to look at any of the underlying facts, is essentially a change in the standard. They want to be able to come and say, so long as we present...
They're not saying we don't want you to look at any of the underlying facts. That's where the ships are crossing in the night between you and the government. The government realizes that historic facts, in order to prove infringement, did the agency do X, Y, and Z, and are involved. But the government's saying pre-litigation conduct has a special feeling, a term of art, in this field, and it really goes to the morality, the propriety of the agency's conduct. So what the government is in essence saying is that if this case had been tried before EJIA got amended to include pre-litigation conduct, how much of what Leto said would not have come in? If you see what I mean.
I understand it. And so
some of what he's talking about, he had the view that filing a patent application is an infringing act. So he said filing the application, writing the papers, these are all things to consider about whether or not the government was reasonable when it came in and said we don't infringe or it's invalid.
Yeah, and I understand that, Your Honor. And I guess what I would say is if you look at why the EJIA Act was amended in 1986. It was to resolve a circuit split to see whether or not the agency's position or lack.
And the majority of the circuits have said the agency's position does not include the bona fides of its arbitrary or capricious or not behavior at the agency level. So they amended the statute to include that body of behavior, right?
Correct, but it didn't change the fact that EAJA cases, both before 1986 and after, are required to look at as part of the analysis of whether or not conduct or positions are substantially filed, is to look at the pertinent facts.
Well, right, but I mean, your case from our circuit where we say you have to look at all the facts, that's a case in which we held you don't look at pre-litigation conduct. So there's a difference between sort of all the facts and then peeling out in this obscure context of attorney's fee suits the pre-litigation conduct that either counts or doesn't count.
Yeah, and in this particular case, Judge Leto, the invention or the violation of the non-disclosure agreement that counsel referenced is not something that Judge Leto relied on in analyzing whether the positions of the United States.
Well, that's debatable. I mean, the chief judge raised that question with your adversary at the very beginning, and you heard what he said, which was, even if we agree with him on the statutory interpretation, there's enough to affirm, meaning your client wins. The difficulty for us is more, because of that concession, is more for future cases, for what happens with litigation for clients like your plaintiff client in the future, whether they'll get the benefit in their own case of pre-litigation conduct to help them to show not substantially justified or not. And the thing that Judge Letow's opinion didn't do, which we've done it today here at oral argument, is to trace the history of how 1498 got amended and what was the intent of Congress. Was it to include or exclude pre-litigation conduct?
I guess the easiest way that I have looked at it, Your Honor, and obviously I can candidly say that my familiarity with the EAJA is not as in-depth as counsel.
Sometimes that's very helpful.
But what is required under the EAJA before you file a claim was there was a separate agency proceeding. And that does not exist or is not required under 1498. And part of amendment to the EAJA is to resolve the circuit split, but it was also to make clear that not only was the claimant entitled to fees for the litigation if the conduct was not substantially justified, it was also entitled to claim fees and costs or recoup fees and costs associated with the prior agency proceeding. So it wouldn't have made sense, in my view, to incorporate similar language into 1498 because there's just not that obligation or that proceeding.
Can I ask a question? So, one of the things that has confused me is the difference between pre-litigation conduct on the one hand, which I don't see why that wouldn't be able to be considered, and then pre-litigation positions of the United States. Do you understand what I'm getting at? The one thing about Judge Leto's opinion that caused me to pause is at page A16, where he's distinguishing under EJA between the position taken in civil litigation and, quote, the action or failure to act by the agency upon which the civil action is based. So, let me be clear. I think you win either way. But it's important for future cases for us to make sure we get the law right. I don't see why he isn't correct that pre-litigation conduct can be considered. However, a pre-litigation position of the government is not to be considered.
Yeah, and I think the challenge, at least for me, is that their brief kind of intertwined those two. But I agree. I make a distinction.
But it doesn't matter to me. In fact, what their brief says, I'm trying to make sure we get the law right.
I understand.
And I think EJA may allow for a pre-litigation position to cause them a problem. And I don't see that this statute does, but that to me, and that's why I want to make sure it's clear, is wholly different from pre-litigation conduct that might inform whether the position they do take in litigation is substantially justified.
I don't know where you can possibly draw the line on pre-litigation conduct. Things that are not a position, whether it be an agency position, I don't know where you draw that line and say, this is not a position.
They had to have taken the position in litigation.
I'm sorry?
They have to have taken the position in litigation.
Correct. But if you're
trying... EJA doesn't seem to require that, right? The EJA statute seems to allow for, I think, more than that.
Yes. As amended, the EJA statute is broader.
Right. There's
no question. And it specifically makes clear something that is not specifically spelled out in 1498, but the legislative history of when they put 1498 in place, the amendments to the EAJA were there. And as I think Your Honor referred to the letter from the DOJ previously that basically said this should be amended to be consistent and interpreted with the EAJA. And so I think the explanation is...
And yet they didn't do it.
Well, but again, I don't know that there's a reason to put in that different sentence into 1498 that's in the EAJA because...
In the definitional sentence that's in a totally different
sentence? Oh, the position of the United States.
Oh, that, yeah. That's
but I do think also that... But it is also putting that in would be inconsistent in the sense that the EAJA has a requirement that is not required under 1498 to have this agency review and to have that position there that is not part of or required in 1498.
You're not suggesting there's sort of a gap in the litigation and this is a Chevron type case, are you?
I don't think so, Your
Honor. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's what did Congress intend when it amended 1498? I mean, there's a history version that favors the government's point of view a little bit, and then you've got your point of view from driven by policy considerations.
Yeah, I mean, I think
it's a challenge. It's a toss-up for us because the government doesn't have an established position on this point, so there's nothing we would defer to here by way of an agency interpretation. And the fallback in that case is you go back to pre-Chevron, just we do the analysis.
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to the previous question about trying to define and distinguish between, I think the answer lies in the distinction between pre-litigation position in pre-litigation conduct. I mean, I think that if you have a pre-litigation position,
doesn't the amendment to EJA amend the words the government position of the government?
Yes.
So they say the position of the government shall be, and then shall include this basically the agency action, right?
Correct. And I think that is the really the only distinction between the two statutes is spelling out what can be included with respect to agency positions. But either way, pre-litigation conduct is appropriate given that it has always been considered with the body of cases interpreting the EAJA before it was amended in 1986, and it has been...
But not in the cases in the circuits, in the majority of the circuits before the amendment of EJA, certain forms of historic pre-litigation conduct were considered inappropriate for determining the position of the United States. It has to be.
I think that goes to Judge Moore's question about how you define what pre-litigation conduct is versus a pre-litigation position. I mean, my view is that pre-litigation conduct that is utilized to evaluate whether or not the position of the United States in litigation is reasonable in fact, that has to be considered. That has always been considered under the law.
Well, in the case law that I read that leads up to this, that deals with the question of the pre-litigation activity, where the government lost because of pre-litigation activity, whereas they were reasonable in court, was not position-taking, but it was behavior-driven by Corps of Engineers and people like that, just acting arbitrary and capricious in the way they treated the party that then had to go to court to seek the relief. I'm not certain that helps.
See, my time is up.
It's way up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I believe my time has probably expired as well, but I...
You've got some time.
I just had a couple quick points, if I could. To Judge Moore's point regarding pre-litigation conduct versus positions. I think our position is that the two collapse here because there are three elements to a 1498 claim: infringement, validity, and damages. The material facts of those are certainly always at play. The conduct of the agency, however, and how they treat the claimant, what they have done maybe in the past or whether they have claimed papers in their own name or things of that nature are certainly acts that that are pre-litigation conduct, but they're also usually coming in as positions.
Yeah, exactly. And those positions, to the extent they're being used as positions, they shouldn't be part of this. But if inherent in them somehow they shed light on whether there was a substantial justification for an actual non-infringement position taken in trial, they could be considered as pieces of evidence, not as positions.
Yes, if they are a material fact to the case, yes, I don't disagree with you there.
That's your way of saying that you'd still like us to say that the pre-litigation position doesn't include the pre-litigation conduct.
I'm sorry, I think I missed the first part of the question.
Well, I mean, you're not giving away your position in the main on the statutory interpretation.
Correct.
Right? You're still saying we should say that Judge Letow was wrong when he said position of the United States includes sort of all forms of pre-litigation conduct.
That is correct. Yes.
Okay, I was wrong because you were out of time, as you correctly observed.
I suspected as much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If I may, just in closing, we think that Broad Avenue, this court's prior decision, was correct and would rely on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We thank both sides. Case is submitted. That concludes our proceeding.